The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's begin with the Reader's Digest. And inspiration section, Luck in the Four-Leaf Clover. One Woman's Knack for Finding Good Fortune by Teva Harrison. And there's a picture here of a whole different types of four-leaf clovers with different dates on them, May 6th, May 14th, May 19th, June 5th, June 18th. When I was in the third grade, we had a scavenger hunt at school. We gathered up chalk, pencils, stones, and poorly hidden tchotchkes, rapidly filling our checklists. It was a very close race. I was out of breath when I reached the clover patch in search of the last, most hard-to-find item, a four-leaf clover. I was pretty sure that I was going to win. I had a trump card. The thing is, I have always been able to find four-leaf clovers. I just see them. I spent my childhood collecting and presiding and pressing four-leaf clovers into books at my mother's house. I started with big cloth and leather-bound books, Joyce's Ulysses, the complete works of Shakespeare, my great-grandmother's copy of Les Mis. When I ran out of romantically bound volumes, I began to slip my treasures into anything I could find, well-thumbed fiction paperbacks, cookbooks. The same is true in my house today. Shake a book, and a papery treasure might just fall into your hand. A few years ago in Nova Scotia, my husband and I pulled off the road for a picnic. The ground was thick with clover. Some shoots had four, five, even six leaves. I lined up on the picnic table to admire as my husband, never yet having found one four-leaf clover in his life, looked on with awe. To me, it was simple. The differences in their shapes popped out, breaking the pretty pattern of the conventional clovers with their three perfect leaves. Two summers back, while waiting for an airport shuttle in Munich, I found a tiny four-leaf clover in a traffic circle and tucked it into my passport. On the way home, my husband and I were upgraded to business class. Friends attributed our good luck to the clover. I think it's more likely that we were upgraded because a flight cancellation left us stranded in two cities on as many continents on subsequent nights, and a kind customer service rep took pity on us. And there's a picture of this young lady. And she's quite attractive. She's wearing a big blue denim hat, and she's holding up three four-leaf clovers. People disagree about whether the luck lies in the finding or in the possession of a clover. Some believe that the luck is lost if the four-leaf clover is even shown to somebody else, while others think the luck doubles if it is given away. I believe that positivity is compounded by sharing. I feel lucky to find the clover so often, but I don't think they influence my life any more than it does to share anything a little special. That momentary closeness between you and a friend or a stranger as you all lean in to wonder at the rare find. What is luck, anyway? Does it mean you can't take credit for the things that happened to you? Shouldn't I have kept all the clovers I found instead of giving them away? I believe that there is casual magic in everyday acts. It's lucky simply to know what it is to seek out and love a genetically deformed clover, to know how to treasure difference. Every time I see a patch of clover, I feel a compulsion to search that cannot be satisfied until I hold a four-leaf clover up in my hands. It's a sort of mania. I had always thought that being a simple genetic anomaly, four-leaf clovers would be fairly common. I have since learned that since 1 in 10,000 clovers has four leaves, it could be the result of a recessive gene, a somatic mutation, the influence of the environment, or any combination of the three. But isn't this where science meets magic? Though I find clovers all the time, I'm not exceptional in this skill. The Guinness World Record holder, Edward Martin Sr. from Cooper Landing, Alaska, has found 111,060 four-leaf clovers when he took the record in 2007. It's the finding I love, not the collecting. I'm happiest to give my lucky clovers away. I pass them on to mothers in parks who show them to their wide-eyed kids. I deliver one to the man at my corner store, where it hangs above the register. Flints slip them between business cards on their wallets for safekeeping. People ask how I do it. Well, I love clover. The sweet smell, the common variant with its cute trio of leaves, I look at it as more than most people do. I expect that's the first reason I find so many. I have a habit of dragging my fingers or toes across a patch, momentarily separating the individuals, which brings irregulators to focus. That's part of finding them, but not a hardening of focus, but a softening. The other reason is artful. Do you remember those posters from the 1980s made up of thick dots? If you looked too hard, all you'd see was the pattern. But if you let your eye slip out of focus, scenes would appear. Dinosaurs, landscapes, butterflies, a trick for the eye. It's the same with four-leaf clovers. If you try too hard, you will only ever see the patch. Instead, slip into a lazy, soft-focused summer state of mind. Drift your hand across a thick patch, letting the clovers reveal themselves. Appreciate the ones that have only three leaves. Common things are beautiful, too. And a four-leaf clover may show itself to you lost just like that. That day in the third grade, I dived into the clover patch, skimming the surface with my hands, softening my eyes to look for irregularities. It took only moments for a four-leaf clover to fall into my fingers. Just like that. Whatever little toy I won that day, my real prize was the gateway to the simple act of looking for clovers opened for me in a lifetime of joy derived from looking closely. The magic of nature coming up as it pleases. True crime. The man who rigged the lottery. He got hold of the winning numbers 5 times. But how? And there's a picture of a guy in a hoodie with numbers behind him from the lottery, and it looks like a policeman looking over his shoulder at him, and a picture of a gas station. The video was grainy, but it showed enough to possibly crack open the biggest lottery scam in American history. A heavyset man walks into the Quick Trip convenience store just off Interstate 80 in Des Moines, Iowa, 2 days before Christmas 2010. The hood of his sweatshirt is pulled over his head, obscuring his face. He grabs a fountain drink and then 2 hot dogs. "Hello," the cashier says brightly. Head down, the man replies in a low-pitched drawl, "Hello." They exchange a few more words. The man pulls up 2 pieces of paper from his pocket. The cashier runs them through the lottery terminal and hands him some change. Once outside, the man pulls off his hood, gets into his SUV, and drives away. The pieces of paper were play slips for Hot Lotto, a lottery game that was available in 14 states in Washington, D.C. A player, or the game's computer, picked 5 numbers and then a 6, known as the Hot Ball. Players who got all 6 numbers right won a jackpot that varied according to how many tickets were sold. At the time of the video, the jackpot was approaching $10 million. The stated odds of winning were 1 in 10,939,383. 6 days later, on December 29th, the Hot Lotto numbers were selected, 3, 12, 16, 26, 33, and 11. The next day, the Iowa Lottery announced that a Quick Trip in Des Moines had sold the winning ticket, but no one came forward to claim the now $16.5 million jackpot. After a month passed, the Iowa Lottery held its news conference to note that the money was still uncollected. The lottery issued a public reminder. 3 months after winning, the numbers were announced, then another at 6 months, and again at 9 months, each time warning that winners had 1 year to claim their money. On November 2011, a man named Philip Johnson, a Canadian attorney, called in with the correct serial numbers from the winning ticket. But when asked what he'd been wearing when he bought his description of a sports coat and gray flannel dress pants, did not match the Quick Trip video. Then in a subsequent call, the man admitted he had fibbed. He said he was helping a client claim the ticket so the client wouldn't be identified. This was against the Iowa lottery rules, which requires identities of winners to be public. Lottery officials were suspicious. The winner's anonymity was worth $16.5 million? I was convinced it would never be claimed, says Mary Neubauer, the Iowa Lottery's vice president of external relations of the jackpot. And it wasn't until exactly a year after the drawing, less than 2 hours before the 4 p.m. deadline, when representatives from a Des Moines law firm showed up at lottery headquarters with the winning ticket. The firm was claiming the prize on behalf of a trust whose beneficiary was a corporation in Belize. Its president was Philip Johnson, the same man who said he'd worn a sports coat to buy the ticket. "Just absolutely stank all over the place," said Terry Rich, chief executive of the Iowa Lottery. So they held on to the jackpot while the Attorney General's office opened an investigation. But it went nowhere. 2 years later, a baby-faced district attorney named Bob Sand inherited the languishing lottery file. In college, Stan had studied computer coding before going to law school, where his specialty was white-collar crime. Still, this case stumped him. His best evidence was that the grainy hit video of a man in a hoodie, so he decided to release the footage to the media, hoping it might spark leads. And it did. The first came from an employee of the Maine Lottery, who recognized a distinct voice in the video as that of a man who had conducted a security audit in their offices. A web developer at the Iowa Lottery also recognized the voice. It belonged to a man she had worked alongside for years, Eddie Tipton. Eddie was the information security director for the Multi-State Lottery Association, based in Des Moines. Among other games the association ran, the Hot Lotto. Eddie cut a big figure around the lottery office. He wrote software, handled network firewalls, and reviewed security for games in nearly three dozen states. His life revolved around his job. He sometimes stayed at a desk until 11 p.m. When a coworker was in a bad mood, one colleague said, Eddie would pat him on the shoulder and say, I just want you to know I'm your friend. But he was also a paranoid sort. He rarely played with credit cards, worried about people tracing his identity. In private moments, Eddie told friends he was lonely and wanted a family more than anything. He built a 4,800 square foot, $540,000 house in a cornfield south of Des Moines, complete with five bedrooms and a stadium-style home theater. Friends wondered why a single man needed such a big house and how he could afford it on his salary. Eddie told them he had poured his savings into the house in hopes of filling it with a wife and children. But the right partner never came along. Among Eddie's friends was a colleague named Jason Marr. They spent hours playing the online game World of Tanks. When Marr saw the Hot Lotto video and D.A. Sand released, Marr immediately recognized that familiar, low-pitched voice. But he didn't want to believe it. That night I sat down. There's no way Eddie did this, Marr said. There's got to be something wrong. So he did what a computer whiz does. He put the file into an audio software, removed the white noise, and isolated the voice. Then he took footage from a security cameras in his own house. Eddie had just visited the night before and compared the voices. It was a complete and utter match, Marr said. The next day he went to the Quick Trip and measured the dimensions of the tiles on the floor, the height of the shelving units, the distance between the door and the cash register. He used the results to compare the hand size, foot size, and height of the man in the video with his friends. Marr went to be able to tell law enforcement that it wasn't his pal Eddie. Once I did this, it was like, well, explicative. It is Eddie. In January 2015, state investigators showed up in Eddie's office. He was arrested and charged with two felony counts of fraud. Half a year later, on a hot, sticky July morning, Rob Sands stood before a jury in the Polk County Courthouse. This is a classic story about an inside job, he began. A man who, by virtue of his employment, is not allowed to play the lottery, nor allowed to win, buys a lottery ticket, wins, and passes a ticket along to be claimed by someone unconnected to him. The prosecution knew Eddie had bought the winning ticket. The video made that pretty clear. So did cell phone records, which showed Eddie was in town that day, not out of town for the holidays as he had claimed. Investigators believed that he'd fixed the lottery. But if the numbers are supposed to be generated by randomly, how did he do it? Based on his research, Sand theorized that before the Hot Lotto jackpot, Eddie had managed to gain access to one of the two computers that select the winning numbers and inserted a thumb drive containing a string of coded instructions he'd written. The clandestine software, called a root kit, allowed Eddie to restrict the pool of numbers that could hit, and then it deleted itself. The prosecutor told the jury members that they didn't have to understand the exact technology to convict Eddie. They just had to realize the near impossible coincidence of the lottery securities chief buying the winning ticket. After deliberating for only 5 hours, the jury found Eddie guilty. He appealed. Then the case took a very strange turn. One morning, a few months after the original trial, Sand's office phone rang. The call came from area code 281 in Texas, where Eddie grew up. The caller said he'd seen an article in the newspaper about Eddie's conviction. Did you all know, the tipster asked, that Eddie's brother Tommy Tipton won the lottery maybe about 10 years back? Sand contacted Richard Renison, a special agent at the FBI office in Texas City, Texas. Renison said he remembered the case well. In 2006, a man named Tom Bargus had contacted local law enforcement with a suspicious story. Bargus owned 44 fireworks stands. Twice a year, after the 4th of July and New Year's, he handled enormous amounts of cash. A man he knew, a local justice of the peace, called Bargus around New Year's and said, "I got $500,000 in cash that I want to swap with your money." What's a justice of the peace who makes around $35,000 a year doing with that much cash? Bargus thought. Suspicious, he called the police, who called the FBI. Soon agents listened in as Bargus met with the justice of the peace, Tommy Tipton. Tommy pulled out a briefcase filled with $450,000 in cash, still in Federal Reserve wrappers, and swapped $100,000 of it for Bargus' worn, circulated bills. The FBI then went to work investigating the serial numbers on the new bills. A few months later, Renison went to see Tommy. He said that he had hit the lottery, but on the outs with his wife, and trying to keep the winning numbers from her, the winnings from her. A friend had claimed the $568,908 prize in exchange for 10% of the money. At the time, it all seemed to add up, and the Tommy Tipton case was closed. Now Sands suspected there was even more illicitly claimed tickets out there. He knew from experience that white-collar criminals aren't usually caught on their first attempt. In fact, a $785,257.72 jackpot from a Wisconsin lottery drawing on December 29, 2007, had been claimed by a Texas man named Robert Rhodes, Eddie Tipton's best friend. On November 23, 2011, Kyle Kahn from Hemp Hill, Texas, won $644,478 in the Oklahoma lottery. Sands saw that Tommy Tipton had three Facebook friends named Kahn. He got a list of possible phone numbers and cross-referenced them with Tommy's cell phone. Another hit. Two winning Kansas lottery tickets with $15,000 payouts were purchased on December 23, 2010, the day Eddie bought the Iowa ticket. Cell phone records indicated he was driving through Kansas on the way to Texas for the holidays. One of the winning tickets was claimed by a Texan named Christopher McCloskey, the other by an Iowan named Amy Warwick. Each was a friend of Eddie's. One morning, Sand and an investigator knocked on Warwick's door. She told them Eddie had said he wasn't able to claim a winning talker ticket because of a job. If she could claim it, he said, she could keep a portion of his gift for her recent engagement. "You have these honest dupes," Sand says. "All these people are being offered thousands of dollars for doing something that's a little bit sneaky but not illegal." Investigators in Iowa now had six tickets they figured were part of a bigger scam. But the question remained, how did it work? Fortunately, the computer used in the 2007 Wisconsin lottery jackpot were sitting in storage. A computer expert, Sean McClendon, unearthed some malicious computer code. It hadn't been hidden. You just needed to know what to look for. This, said Wisconsin Assistant District Attorney David Moss, was finding the smoking gun. Eddie Tipton pleaded guilty, as did his brother, Tommy. Now facing 10 years in prison, Eddie agreed to spill the secrets, which lottery officials hoped would help them safeguard the games in the future. He explained that the whole scheme had started fairly innocently one day when he walked past one of the accountants in the Multi-State Lottery Association. "Hey, did you put your secret numbers in there, the accountant teased Eddie. "What do you mean?" "Well, you know you can set numbers on any given day since you wrote the software." "Just like a little seed that was planted," Eddie said. "And then during one slow period, I tried it." To ensure that the winning numbers were generated randomly, the computer took a reading from a Geiger counter that measured the radiation in the surrounding air. The radiation reader was plugged into the logarithm to come up with the winning lottery number. Said, that's kind of cool. Eddie's scheme was to limit the random selection process as much as possible. His code kicked in only if the coming drawing fulfilled a narrow set of circumstances. It had to be on a Wednesday or a Saturday evening, and one of the three dates in a non-leap year, the 147th day of the year, the 327th day, or the 363rd day. Investigators noticed those days generally fell around the holidays, Memorial Day, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, when Eddie was often on vacation. If those criteria were satisfied, The random number generator was diverted to a different track that didn't use Geiger computer readings. Instead, the logarithm made a predetermined number, which restricted the pool of potential winning numbers to a much smaller, predictable set of options. Rather than millions of possible winning combinations, there would only be a few hundred. The night before the first lottery he rigged, a $4.8 million jackpot in Colorado, Eddie stayed late in his messy computer-filled office. He set a test computer and run the program over and over again, and wrote down all the potential winning numbers on a yellow legal pad. The next day, November 23, 2005, he handed the pad to his brother, who was headed to Colorado on a trip. "These numbers have a good chance of winning based on my analysis," said. "Play them. Play them all." On a clear summer day in Des Moines last year, Eddie Tipton, who was then 54, trudged up the stairs to the Polk County Courthouse. His hands were shoved into his pockets, his head down. He had accepted a plea deal from masterminding to Masson's lottery scam. One count of ongoing criminal conduct, part of a package deal that gave his brother only 75 days. Eddie was here for his sentencing. In statements to prosecutor, he painted himself as a kind of coding Robin Hood, stealing from the lottery and helping people in need. His brother had five daughters, his friend who'd just gotten engaged. "I didn't really need the money," Eddie said. The judge noted that Eddie seemed to rationalize his actions, that he didn't think it was necessarily illegal, just taking advantage of a hole in the system, sort of like counting cards at a casino. The judge sentenced Eddie to a maximum of 25 years in prison. The brother's restitution to the various state lotteries came to $2.2 million, even though, according to his attorney, Eddie himself pocketed only around $350,000. Sand expects Eddie to be released on parole within 7 years. Reflecting on the case, the prosecutor said he felt a deep intellectual satisfaction in solving the puzzle. The justice system, at its best, really is about a search for the truth. The luckiest town around, where 31 oil refinery employees shared a $45 million lottery jackpot this year, destined to win? Destined to win. Maybe. After all, they work in a Canadian town called Come By Chance. And here's a little stuff from the Unfreeze Your Brain Genius section they keep adding here. The 100-word mystery. Lois and Helen, widowed sisters, lived together out in the country. Their habits never changed. Up at dawn, breakfast, some housework, and gardening until lunch. In the afternoon, Helen napped while Lois watched her shows. Helen never watched TV. Then Helen would clean the vegetables for dinner and Lois would cook. In the evening, they'd read before bed. One night before they turned in, a storm knocked out the power. Everything was pitch black and Lois began to panic. "What should we do?" she cried. Helen just smiled and kept reading. Why didn't Helen stay calm while her sister did not? The answer, Helen was blind. We can relate to that, can't we, folks? Jake loves steak, Trish loves fish. Jacob enjoys steak so much that the probability that he'll have it for dinner on any given evening is 1 in 3. The favorite dish of his wife, Patricia, is fresh fish. The probability that she'll have it for dinner on any given night is 1 in 2. Because Jacob and Patricia always dine together, they never have steak and fish on the same night. On average, how many times in a 30-day month will they be having either steak or fish? The answer? 25 nights. Don't ask me how they figured that. I can't do that. Unfreeze your brain. Can use these items to attach a candle to the wall. It shows a stick pin and matches. Are you tired of jettison tired thinking patterns in which develop even the most intelligent among us? In life, once on a path, we tend to follow it, for better or worse. What's sad is that even if it's the latter, we often accept it anyway because we are so accustomed to the way things are that we don't even recognize that they could be different. This is a phenomenon psychologists call functional fixedness. This classic experiment will give you an idea of how it works and a sense of whether you may have fallen into the same trap. People are given a box of tacks and some matches and ask to find a way to attach a candle to a wall so that it burns properly. Typically, subjects try tacking the candle to the wall or lighting it to affix it to melted wax. The psychologists had, of course, arranged it so that neither of these obvious approaches would work. The tacks are too short, and the paraffin doesn't bind well to the wall. So how can you accomplish the task? The successful technique is to use the tack box as a candle holder. You employ it, you empty it, tack it to the wall, and stand the candle inside it. To think of that, you have to look beyond the box's usual role as a receptacle, just for tacks, and reimagine it serving as an entire new purpose. That's difficult because we all suffer to one degree or another from functional fixedness. The inability to think in new ways affects people from every corner of society. The political theorist Hannah Arendt coined the phrase frozen thoughts to describe deeply held ideas that we no longer question but should. In Arendt's eyes, the complacent reliance on such accepted truths also made people blind to ideas that didn't fit their worldview, even when there was ample evidence for them. Frozen thinking has nothing to do with intelligence, she said. It can be found in highly intelligent people. Arendt was particularly interested in the origins of evil. She considered critical thinking to be a moral imperative. In its absence, a society could go from the way of Nazi Germany. Another context in which frozen thinking can turn into dangerous is medicine. If you land in the hospital, it's natural to want to be treated by the most experienced physician on staff. But according to a 2014 study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, you'd be better off being treated by the relative novices. The study examined nearly 10 years of data involving tens of thousands of hospital admissions and found that the 30-day mortality rate among high-risk patients with acute heart conditions was a third lower when the top doctors were away at conferences. The JAMA study didn't pinpoint the reasons for the decreased death care, but the author explains that most errors made by doctors are connected to a tendency to form opinions quickly based on experience. In cases that are not routine, the expert doctors may miss important aspects of the problem that are not consistent with their initial analysis. As a result, although junior doctors may be slower and less confident in treating run-of-the-mill cases, they can be more open-minded with unusual cases. How to think outside the box. In addition to being open to dissenting opinions, there are some techniques that could help broaden the way you think. Number one, change environments. A disruption to your everyday life may provide the force needed to alter the direction of your thinking. For some people, small changes might help, reorganizing your desk or taking a new route to work, whereas for others, more upheaval, a new job or a divorce, is required. Number two, look as if you've never seen. A Zen Buddhist contest for approaching even routine situations as if you were encountering them for the first time. Beginner's mind allows you to remain open to new experiences despite any expertise you may have. For instance, when you brush your teeth, take a moment to look at the toothbrush as if you've never laid eyes on such an object and notice its color and shape. Think about the flavor of the toothpaste and notice how your mouth feels as you move the brush back and forth. Number three, vive la difference. The mere presence of individuals from the different backgrounds with different points of view in your everyday life creates an atmosphere in which people can better respond to change. A shift in positivity. Number four, unlike negative emotions that trigger specific reactions, e.g., fear propels us to flee, positive emotions prompt us to broaden our attention, explore our environment, and open ourselves to absorbing information. Take a few moments to think about the things in your life that are going well, for which you are grateful. This will automatically brighten your mood and free your brain. Fortunately, psychologists have found that anyone can unfreeze his or her thinking. One of the most effective ways to introduce a little discord in one's intellectual interactions. Consider a study performed about half a century ago. The researchers showed two groups of female volunteers a sequence of blue slides. In both groups, he asked each individual to state the color of each slide. In the experimental group, he had planted some actors who called the color green rather than blue. Whom were they fooling? Nobody. The experimental subject ignored the deviant responses. When their turns came, most of the bands were blue, just as the control group had. Then the subjects were asked to classify as a series of paint chips as either green or blue, even though their color lay between those two pure colors. Amazingly, the people who had been in the experimental group identified many chips as green, while those from the cold group called the same ones blue. Even though no one in the experimental group had been convinced by the actors before, their exposure to the earlier misidentification had shifted their judgment and made them more open to seeing the color as green. Other experiments have shown that dissent can not only sway us with regard to the issue at hand, it can also thaw frozen thinking in general, even in contexts unrelated to the original discussion. What does all this mean is that, as difficult as it can sometimes be, talking to people who disagree with you is good for your brain. So if you hate conspiracy theories and run into someone who believes that we faked the moon landing, don't walk away. Have tea with him or her. It can broaden your thinking in countless ways. And let's close out this month's Reader's Digest with a couple of Life in News United States. Knowing that the pastor enjoyed a drink, his hotel owner offered him a case of cherry brandy for Christmas in exchange for a free ad in the church's newsletter. The pastor agreed and ran this for the next issue. The pastor would like to thank Patrick Smith for his kind gift of a crate of fruit and for the spirit in which it was given. Whoever coined the phrase "the pitter-patter of little feet" clearly never heard a four-year-old walk. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. We were last week, in the last while, we've been talking about medical tests you do and don't need. And we left off with electrocardiograms and EKGs. And the next one is the full-body CT scans. These are multiple x-rays to image the body and internal organs. Why it's done? They're typically marketed as a way to detect early signs of cancer, heart disease, and other conditions. The American Medical Association, among others, advises against these except in rare instances, and not for healthy people. Those rare cases may include people with cancer that may have spread, or in an emergency, those with a significant injury. Possible outcomes. If the scan finds gross or abnormalities, you might need other tests and treatment. These scans often find abnormalities, an average of 3 per person, that almost always turn out to be harmless, according to a 2013 analyst by Air Force researchers. 1/3 of people have unnecessary follow-ups that expose them to additional radiation. Heart scans. Coronary CT angiography, CCTA, and coronary artery calcium, CAC scans, use multiple x-rays to image your arteries. Why it's done? Both check for plaque and arteries. A CCTA scan also looks for structural abnormalities. Recommended for those with symptoms such as shortness of breath and chest pain, the CCTA, and those at risk of heart disease, the CAC. The Society of Cardiovascular Computed Tomography advises against both for most other people. Possible outcomes. A CAC scan may help people at risk decide with their doctor how aggressively they treat their condition. For those with symptoms, either screening may be used with other tests to diagnose heart disease. For those at low risk, the tests expose them to radiation unnecessarily and can lead to unneeded procedures. However, for some people, like myself, when you have a heart attack, they do that just to make sure to find out what blockage is. Mammograms and other breast cancer screenings. With a mammogram, your breast is compressed between two plates and an x-ray is taken. An increasing number of facilities use multiple x-rays to create a 3D image called digital breast tomosynthesis. Also available are magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, which uses strong magnets and radio waves to create a detailed image of the breast and ultrasound imaging. Why it's done? To detect breast cancer early, when it may be more treatable. Recommended. 4. Major medical organizations agree that women should be offered the option to have a screening mammogram at age 40. The ACS advises women to start at age 45. The USPTCF recommends age 50. And the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says no later than 50. Recommendations on frequency vary from 1 to 2 years. Studies suggest that 3D tests may detect slightly more cancers than standard mammograms, but haven't shown yet that they save more lives. Ultrasound imaging and an MRI can find cancers that a mammogram can miss, but also pick up harmless abnormalities. These tests aren't thought to be beneficial on their own, but are useful in conjunction with mammograms for women at high risk. Possible outcomes. These screenings may detect invasive breast cancer before they spread, sparing women more extensive treatment and possibly saving lives. But all can result in false positives, leading to untoward followed-up imaging and biopsies. The tests can also miss some cancers, so it's important to talk with your doctor about your health history and risk factors and what type of screening is best for you. There's insufficient evidence about the effectiveness of screening after the age of 75. Lung cancer scan. This low-dose CT scan images the lungs. Why it's done? It's been found to detect lung cancer early and prevent death among those at highest risk. Recommended for adults 55 to 80 with a 30-pack-a-year history, smoking a pack of cigarettes daily for 30 years, or two packs for 15 years. Who currently smoke or quit within the past 15 years should be screened yearly, says the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. But fewer than 2% of them are tested, the American Society of Clinical Oncology notes. Possible outcomes. If anything suspicious is found, additional screening or a lung biopsy will be necessary. Note, this screening has a very high rate of false positives. According to the 2013 UPSTF analysis, for every lung cancer death the scan prevents, 302 people without disease test positive. Mouth and neck cancer screening. Healthcare providers perform a physical and visual examination that may include the face, neck, nose, mouth, and throat as part of a routine exam. Why it's done? To check for cancers and precancers. Recommended for hospitals and clinics routinely host free public screenings, but major medical organizations such as USPSTF and ACS and the American Dental Association, ADA, don't recommend this screening for healthy people. There's no clinical study showing that the exam saves lives, says Otis Brawley, MD. The ADA does advise dentists to be alert for abnormalities during a dental exam, especially in people who smoke or drink, because those habits heighten cancer risks. Possible outcomes. If anything suspicious is found, a doctor will do a biopsy and remove the lesion if it's cancerous. Most growths found are harmless, so the exam could lead to a false positive and an unnecessary biopsy and treatment. PAP and HPV cervical cancer tests. In a PAP test, or PAP smear, and an HPV test, your doctor removes cells from your cervix and examines them. Why it's done? The PAP looks for precancerous changes in cervical cells. The HPV looks for the types of human papillomavirus that causes cell changes. Both may indicate a cervical cancer risk. Recommended for women ages 21 to 29 should have a PAP smear every 3 years, according to USPSTF, ACS, and other organizations. Those 30 to 65 can follow that schedule or lengthen the time to 5 years if they get an HPV test at the same time. After several normal results, you can stop screening at age 65. Women who've had a hysterectomy that included removal of their cervix and have never had cervical cancer or high-grade precancerous lesions don't need the screening. Possible outcomes. Your doctor may biopsy abnormal cells and, if necessary, destroy them with a laser or extreme cold, or remove them surgically. These tests may lead to unnecessary treatment for women with false positives, notably when screenings don't follow the recommendations. Testing for women younger than 21 is more likely to pick up harmless and temporary cell changes than potentially harmful ones. Prostate cancer PSA test. This blood test checks for elevated level of the prostate-specific antigen, PSA, protein produced by the prostate. Why it's done? High levels may be caused by prostate cancer. Recommended for those who've already been diagnosed with prostate cancer to help doctors monitor them. Men in their 50s and 60s might consider the test after discussing the risk and benefits with their doctor, according to guidelines from the ACS, ACP, and USPSTF, especially when it differs from organizations to organizations. The ACS also recommends that men at higher risk, such as African Americans, consider earlier screening. Men 70 and older shouldn't be screened, according to USPSTF, because the risk outweigh the potential benefits. Possible outcomes. Radiations or prostate removal surgery for those who require treatment. The test, however, often flags non-cancerous conditions such as an enlarged prostate or non-aggressive cancers. Men should understand before they have the test that there's a chance they may be diagnosed with a cancer that should just be watched rather than treated. Skin cancer screening. A healthcare provider inspects your skin visually. Why it's done? For indications of skin cancer, rates of melanoma and most deadly skin cancer have been rising for 30 years. Recommended for people at an increased risk, men older than 50 and people who have more than 50 moles, those with large unusual moles, fair skin, or reduced immunity, or those with a personal or strong family history of skin cancer should be screened, according to the American Academy of Dermatology. If you're among them, talk with a dermatologist about their frequency. Everyone should familiarize themselves with their blemishes, moles, and freckles, says the ACS, and see a dermatologist if they note unusual spots, including those that are changing, itching, or bleeding. Possible outcomes. Your doctor may biopsy a suspicious spot. For a diagnosed skin cancer, treatments depend on the type and extent. Thyroid cancer screening. An ultrasound is used to image the butterfly-shaped gland in the front of your neck. Why it's done? To check for possible cancer of the thyroid. Recommended for those who have risk factors such as a close family history of thyroid cancer or radiation exposure such as radiation therapy, or if you and your doctor notice a lump in your neck. Others can skip it, according to USPSTF, ACS, and other organizations. Possible outcomes. A scan can help locate a lump that might be cancerous, or for high-risk patients, find cancers before they become large enough to be felt. Most of the time, it detects harmless nodules or non-aggressive cancers. A vast majority of thyroid cancers grow very slowly. If the scan suggests cancer and follow-up tests confirm it, talk with your doctor about whether treatment is really needed or whether watchful waiting is a good option. Type 2 diabetes blood sugar screening. Two blood tests are commonly used. A fasting glucose test measures the blood sugar levels after you've gone without calories for at least 8 hours. And an A1C test determines your average blood sugar levels over the past 3 months. Why it's done. High levels can signify diabetes. Slightly elevated levels indicate prediabetes, increasing your risk of the full-blown disease. Recommended for people younger than 45 who are overweight and have at least one other risk factor, such as high blood pressure or cholesterol, a family history of diabetes, or a sedentary lifestyle, should be screened according to the American Diabetes Association and other medical organizations. If results are normal, retest every 3 years. For borderline, high, prediabetes, every 1 to 2 years. One point of disagreement for people 45 and older without risk factors. The ADA recommends screening, but the USPSTF says it's unnecessary. David Nathan, MD, a professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School and director of the Diabetes Center of Massachusetts General Hospital, suggests following the ADA's recommendation. Screening for diabetes is simple, safe, and inexpensive, he notes. Possible outcomes. If results suggest diabetes, you'll need to retest to confirm, because many factors, including medication and stress, can affect your blood sugar. If diabetes or prediabetes is diagnosed, you'll need to make dietary and exercise changes. For diabetes, you'll probably need medication, too. And since we're in the beginning of the year, this is probably a good article to follow. 5 Smart Money Moves. Start off the new year with a few simple financial steps that can increase your savings, protect you from fraud, and help you prosper in the months ahead and for years to come. Number 1. Protect your nest egg from inflation. After barely budging for years, inflation is beginning to heat up. For anyone who's already retired or nearing retirement, even a 1 or 2 percentage point rise in inflation can pose a risk to financial security. The best strategy is to design a broadly diversified, low-cost retirement portfolio that can hold up under a wide range of economic conditions, including a surge in inflation. In addition to getting higher yields on savings, see tip number 5, return on your savings, here are some other timely moves. Keep stocks in your asset mix. It's essential to hold a position in stocks for growth. You also need bonds to provide an income cushion during market downturns. Holding a balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds is the best way to navigate a change in economic cycle. A 50-50 stock and bond mix, which gives you growth and income, is a good starting point for retirees, said David Blanchett, head of retirement research at Morningstar Investment Management. Add some TIPS bonds, that's T-I-P-S bonds. There's no perfect hedge against rising prices. But Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, TIPS, come pretty close. With TIPS, principal value is adjusted to keep up with inflation as measured by the Consumer Price Index. You can invest in TIPS through mutual funds or exchange-traded funds, ETFs. You can also buy individual bonds or treasurydirect.gov. Fran Kennery, principal in the investment strategy group at Vanguard, recommends that people in or near retirement consist in investing a portfolio of their fixed income stake in a short-term TIPS fund. With their shorter maturities, these funds are very quick to react to inflation, says Kennedy. Short-term TIPS funds are also less volatile than their longer maturity peers when interest rates are moving up and down. Freeze your credit report. This is number two. Freezing your credit report is one of the most effective ways to prevent someone from fraudulently opening an account in your name. Since September, federal law has required that the big three credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, allow consumers to freeze their credit reports free of charge, thanks in part to the CR advocacy efforts. So if you've been procrastinating, put freezing your credit reports on the top of your resolution list. Just go to each agency's website, search for security freeze or credit freeze, and fill out an electronic form. You have to temporarily lift credit freezes to apply for credit. Some security experts recommend also freezing your report with Enovis, another credit reporting agency. Credit reporting agencies also sell credit locks. Christina Tetrault, a senior staff attorney in the financial services team at Consumers Union, the Advocacy Division of Consumer Reports, says freezing your report is a safer option. A freeze offers stiffer protections that are guaranteed by law. A credit lock is a contractual agreement. Number three, safeguard against cell phone account fraud. What it is, a rapidly emerging scam in which a crook uses someone's stolen personal data to open up a fraudulent cell phone account in that person's name. The fraudster can then use the account to access and empty out the person's bank account or to open up credit cards in his or her name. Unlike many other types of scams, there are fewer consumer protections for cell phone fraud. In 2017, the number of victims jumped 63% from a year earlier to about 340,000, according to the consulting firm Javelin. Wow, I've never heard of that before. What you can do to protect yourself? Obviously, freeze your credit report. The best way to protect yourself from cell phone account fraud is to freeze your credit reports. For even greater security, you should also freeze your credit report at the National Consumers Telecom and Utilities Exchange, which most cell phone providers use to determine a new customer credit risk. Go to nctue.com or call 866-349-5355. I'll repeat that. nctue.com, call number 1-866-349-5355. Get a PIN for your cell phone account. Most cell phone service providers allow, but do not require, customers to set up a personal identification number. Taking this step can greatly reduce the chances of an unauthorized person accessing your account. Call your cell phone service provider or check its website for information on how to set up a PIN. And if you're suddenly unable to make calls or you stop receiving calls or texts, someone may be illegally using your number. Contact your wireless provider immediately. Number four, rethink how you pay for doctor's visits. The new year is when many of us start thinking about what we'll have to spend on medical care in the coming months. Joining a direct primary care or DPC medical practice will give you around-the-clock access to your doctor and can save you money on primary care. Also referred to as a retainer or concierge medicine, DPC practices typically offer almost unfettered access to one of their primary care physicians and general services such as prevention screenings and diagnostic tests. Minor urgent care services such as stitches are also available. Clients pay a flat fee of usually less than $100 per month. DPC services can be cost-effective and convenient for people with chronic health problems that need close monitoring, such as diabetes, high cholesterol, and hypertension. Some practices dispense prescriptions and offer lab tests, such as electrocardiograms, on site, and will make house calls if you're not feeling well enough to get to the doctor's office. According to industry estimates, there are more than 900 DPC practices across the 48 states in Washington, D.C. That's up from 273 locations in 39 states in 2015. An estimated 500,000 patients are receiving care from DPC practices. It's important to understand that DPC is not insurance or a replacement for it and will not cover more expensive care such as surgery or emergency services. it works best as an add-on to an existing health plan. In fact, DPC practices generally encourage you to pair your membership with an insurance plan, usually a low-premium, high-deductible policy, to cover things such as inpatient hospital care and emergency services. DPC services are also considered outside the scope of insurance regulation in at least 24 states, meaning their members might not be entitled to all the consumer protections mandated by the Affordable Care Act, including coverage of pre-existing conditions. But for people who make frequent appointments with their primary care doctor, joining a DPC could cost less than using the coverage provided by a traditional insurance plan. Just be sure you're also covered by a comprehensive plan for more extensive care, should you need it. Number 5, get maximum returns on your savings. Recent interest rate hikes mean you can now get the highest return on savings in years. Here are 6 ways to get the most for your money. Online savings accounts. Yield, currently around 1.8% or more. Risk level, extremely low for FDIC-insured accounts, which are federally insured up to $250,000 per holder. Where to find them? Compare current rates, minimum deposit, fees, and features of websites such as bank rate and deposit accounts. Remember, the bank has offered this account type for several years. The current annual percentage yield is less likely to be a teaser that will later drop. Money market deposit accounts, MMDAs, yield currently as high as 2.25%. Risk level extremely low. Like savings accounts, they're federally insured. Where to find them? You can compare MMDAs on websites such as bank rate and deposit accounts. Remember, MMDAs may offer more rate stability for higher balances, for instance, more than $10,000, than online savings accounts offer. Money market funds. Yield currently about 2.25%. Risk level very low, although they are not federally insured. Where to find them? They're offered by mutual funds and/or investment companies and are easy to set up and use within your brokerage account. Remember, while they typically require a minimum deposit of $500, there's no limit to how much or how often you can invest or withdraw after the initial investment. High yield reward checking accounts. Yield currently as much as 5%. Risk level extremely low. They are federally insured. Where to find them? You can find and compare high yield reward checking accounts on websites such as deposit accounts. Remember, account holders typically must make 12 to 15 debit card transactions and at least one direct deposit per month. You'll get the top rate only up to a certain balance, usually $10,000. Above that amount, the interest rate drops sharply. Treasury bills and notes. Yield. U.S. Treasury bills that mature in 1 year have been at auction for about 2.5% of late. Higher rates are available for Treasury notes with longer maturities. Risk level. Extremely low. They're backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Where to find them? Buy them directly at treasurydirect.gov. Remember, interest on Treasury bills and notes is exempt from state and local tax. Certificates of Deposits, CDs. Yield. One-year CDs are currently offering APYs as high as 2.75%. Risk level. Extremely low. CDs are federally insured. Where to find them? CDs are offered by banks and credit unions. You can research rates and terms at websites such as bank rate and deposit accounts. Remember, with rates rising, you may want to stick with CDs that mature in a year or less to avoid missing out on future rate hikes. Road report. Ask our experts. What's the safest way to use Waze in my car? That's W-A-Z-E. The Waze navigation app allows drivers to notify other Waze users about police, traffic, and road hazards by tapping on-screen buttons. While this can be a distracting on a phone, viewing directions and interacting with the app on the car's infotainment screen is less so. Waze has been available on Android Auto for more than a year, but it was only recently added to Apple CarPlay. Now iPhone users with iOS 12 or newer can use Waze with the infotainment screens on many newer autos. Recalls, Honda Accord and Insight. Honda is recalling 232,140 of its 2018 Accord sedans and 2019 Insight hybrid sedans because faulty software may cause the backup cameras to fail. CR was an early supporter of requiring backup cameras in all cars. Vehicles sold in the U.S. and built after May 1, 2018 are required to have a camera built in. What to do? Dealers will reprogram the software at no charge. Owners may contact Honda customer service at 888-234-2138. Honda's numbers for this recall are K2G and V2F. In a Consumer Reports survey of vehicle owners, a blind spot warning. I'm sorry. Let me skip something real quick here. 35% of people value a new large sedan will lose during the first hour of ownership. SUVs lose just 18%. Wow, that's a big drop. Blind spot warning success. In a Consumers Report survey of vehicle owners, 66% reported that a blind spot warning, BSW, safety system helped them avoid a crash. BSW alerts a driver when another vehicle is traveling along either side of the car. Available on about 81% of new models, BSW is standard on only about 17% of them, which often means shoppers often have to buy pricier trim levels to get this valuable feature. CR thinks BSW should come standard on all newer vehicles, along with automatic emergency braking and forward collision warning safety systems. In October, CR began adding points to the overall school of vehicles that come with standard with BSW to give automakers an incentive to make this investment in the safety of their customers. To fill a few seconds of time here, I'll give you a preview of what we'll talk about next week concerning Run for Your Life. Only 48% of women versus 54% of men meet the recommended guidelines for aerobic activity. 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise per week. Being active delays cognitive decline and extends the number of years of independent life. Exercising consistently helps prevent the heart disease, improve sleep, boost mood, increase tone and muscle strength, and enhance the overall quality of life. To make the most of your workout, track your heart rate using a smartwatch or a fitness tracker. To use a treadmill or elliptical machine that works with a chest strap heart rate monitor. Always use the treadmill safety key. It clips to your clothes and stops the machine if you fall, helping to prevent additional injury. And that's basically what we'll start discussing next week. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest of Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content in the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.